Welcome to New Books in Political Science. Today I have the real pleasure to talk with Benedetta Berti, who is the author of Armed Political Organizations from Conflict to Integration. Benedetta, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. A pleasure to have read your book. Before we get into it, and it's a meaty, complex book, maybe we can learn just a little bit more about you and your affiliations and your background and where you are now.
Sure. Well, right now I am a fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies, which is a semi-affiliated think tank, part of Tel Aviv University, that deals with national security, foreign policy, and Middle Eastern affairs in general. At the INSS, I am one of their fellows. I work mostly on issues that are related to human security in the broadest sense of the word. On top of that, I'm also a lecturer at Tel Aviv University and at Ben Gurion University, also in Israel, where I basically deal with a number of issues from democratization theory to social movement theory to social protest, strategic nonviolence struggle, and I try to apply all these concepts to the Middle East. So that's a little bit about my background.
Yeah, and your book does such a good job of integrating the very complex histories, not just of the region, which many people have told, but of these organizations, which must have taken just a lot of work. I don't know how transparent and open the information is about these organizations, and to be clear, the organizations you focus on are Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Irish Republican Army.
Yeah.
I wonder, before we talk specifically about the book, if you can talk a little bit about just how you did the book, how you did the research. Are there open archives that you use?
Is
this done based on interviews? Mm-hmm. How did you do this? Because you've gotten close to organizations that I have to assume aren't always open to public inspection.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Very good point to start the conversation. I mean, this originally was my PhD. I did my PhD at the Fletcher School at Tufts in international relations, and this started as a PhD program, then turned into a book. So I've been working on this for two, three years plus the research. So it took a long time to put it together. I did quite a bit of field research, both especially for the cases of Hezbollah and Hamas. I spent quite a bit of time in Lebanon and in Palestine, and then I also did field research for the IRA, but less. For that, I relied more on archival documents because there is a very dense historiography on the group. For Hamas and Hezbollah, I relied on documentary research, but also a lot on field research, interviewing with people that have know the group, that work with the group, that are their political foes and political allies. So I spoke with a wide range of stakeholders in both Lebanon and Palestine. I have to say, when it comes to studying groups like Hamas and Hezbollah, I think a lot depends on which angle, which part of the organization you're trying to study. Meaning, when trying to study their political strategy, like I do, there is a little bit more openness from the group to discuss these issues. If someone is trying to study their military apparatus and their more secretive organizational structure, that's when I think bigger obstacles are encountered. For my part, I did find quite a bit of openness, especially when I was doing my field research in Lebanon. That was when Hezbollah still used to have a PR office and still used to set up interviews with researchers. They have changed that since, but I was lucky enough to have that access to the organization, which I think added some level of depth to the description of the group.
Yeah, and it shows up in your writing. I mean, in some ways, this is, you could take out of this a real master course on how to do this type of qualitative and elite interviews, and it really does show up in the writing. But the book also has a deep theoretical contribution to make. And before we get to the approach that you take, you describe the way that major international players typically approach parties. So, for example, you describe that the U.S. might label a group a terrorist group, while Australia, for the same group, would label it a political organization. And you write in Chapter 2, and I quote, A fundamental problem with both of these approaches is their reliance on a binary classification system. So what is the problem with using this kind of binary classification, which Australia, United States, and other nations will typically use when they approach the kinds of organizations that you focused on?
Right. So there are many problems. I will start with what triggered my interest and started this research, which is the more policy-oriented dilemma here. And a lot of it is when you try to label a group and you give it one adjective, like terrorist organization, you put it in a very specific box. Now, that box may adequately describe some of the activities that group undertakes, but in most circumstances, it will fall short of really giving you a rich description of what the group stands for. So when I look at an organization like Hamas or like Hezbollah, I can pretty confidently say that two-thirds of their activities are political or social activism. I'm not saying that there is no connection between political activism, social activism, and military strategy. The three of them are very closely interrelated. However, if I only focus on the military side, I'm losing a lot of complexity. And the risk is that I will fail to understand what drives the organization, how the organization operates, how it adapts. In other words, I'm just seriously oversimplifying a complex political, social, and military organization. And if my objective as a decision maker is to find an effective strategy to counter or integrate whatever the case may be, that political organization, then my first job would be to understand it. So if I only look at the terrorist activities, I will most likely fail to understand how the group operates. And most likely the strategies I will come up with to deal with this group will also fall short because they don't meet the complexity of the group and the complexity of the challenges that these groups pose. So yeah. It was a very much, practitioner-driven query that started my research, but there's also a very strong, I think, more scholarly debate about the power of labeling and how that influences our choices in terms of devising political strategies.
Yeah, and let's talk about this in specifics, because your book is just chock full of specifics. An organization such as Hezbollah in Lebanon is much more complicated than this binary system would permit. So how is Hezbollah organized? You described it as highly institutionalized. How so? In what ways is it is the organization institutionalized and in organized in a highly institutionalized way?
Right. So part of what I did in the book was to move a little bit beyond this binary classification of this organization as either political or armed, and I kind of looked at them as hybrid organizations. And I tried to apply some organizational theory on them and to really look at the internal power relations within this organization and also to look at how practically these organizations are function and how they are structured. And I think that's something that I think has a value in itself, but I did it for the purpose of showing this constant tension between political and military activism. Now, the case of Hezbollah I chose because I think it's a very good example of how to structure an organization in a highly hierarchical, tightly hierarchical way. Hezbollah is a group that has basically it's organized like a pyramid. At the top of the pyramid, you have the Shura Council, which is sort of the legislative body. Together with this legislative body, you have the Secretary General. They run the organization together, and they basically oversee all other organizational activities, be them political, be them military, be them social. So for sure, one of the main characteristics of Hezbollah is that he has very strong internal command and control, as quite a low tolerance for internal dissent, and it has an extraordinarily resilient and continuity of leadership. The main Secretary General has been in power since 1992, and as such, he has been really able to evolve within the organization and to take control of all the different activities that Hezbollah carries out in its daily activities. And as such, has been really able to establish remarkable internal control. out.
Yeah.
My point is that the fact that all organizational activities, including political activism and military activities, are perceived as complementary, so they're perceived as really reinforcing the group's branding and the group's popularity and its legitimacy and its position and power, most importantly. Because those activities are perceived as complementary, then there is very little tension within the organization. And then I compare this with other groups like Hamas, where, on the contrary, you do have internal friction along this political-military line. The idea is that internal dynamics really matter, and when you sort of treat all these groups as equals, you're oversimplifying and really missing out a lot of potential to deal with these groups in a more effective way.
Right, and the description of Hezbollah and some of its social welfare programming is just really interesting, and it seems that some of the argument that you're making is through its early years, the social dimension of the organization is a real prominent part of what it does. But much of your book is about these transitions and these shifts in purpose into politics. And so by the early 1990s, you argue that things begin to change for Hezbollah, and your central thesis seems like it's in part that changes in the political environment are associated with the adoption of political function or a political wing.
Correct.
So what changed in Lebanon and the Middle East more generally that led Hezbollah to begin to move towards a political strategy and then later an electoral strategy?
Right. This is part of the work I do. I look at these organizations, and because I assume they're rational players, and I assume that the decision to create a political wing and to compete in election is the result of cost-benefit evaluation, I look at what factors were present when this decision was made. And what I find, and it's of course just the beginning of what could be a larger study, but what I find is that there are recurring factors, meaning that all these groups start to invest in institutional politics when similar things happen. Now, in the case of Hezbollah, I see that one important influence is the fact that the group decides to shift from focusing mostly or exclusively on its resistance military activity to political activism with the end of the Lebanon Civil War. There is a bloody civil war that reaches in Lebanon from 1975 to 1989. Then Lebanon moved beyond the war through the Taif Accord post-civil war rearrangement of the political arena that creates a better political system in terms of better electoral rules for Hezbollah and the Shia community. So the group perceived there is an opening in the political space, an opening for the group to participate, and most importantly, not just to participate, but to have some sort of influence in the political. There are a few other factors that contribute to heighten this perception that the political system is ripe for participation. One is that after the civil war, Syria becomes extremely involved in Lebanese political life. It's basically designed to be the guarantor of the peace. As the guarantor of peace, Syria is heavily involved in Lebanese political life and is heavily involved in basically making sure that all types of political decisions are taken in a manner that are to this, let's say, goes along with Syria's interests. So among Syria's interests is to boost Hezbollah's profile. It's actually more complicated than that, because on the one hand, Syria wants to control Hezbollah. On the other hand, they appreciate their role in Lebanese society, so they decide to allow them and to foster their political participation and to allow them to preserve at the same time a military wing. So basically, the entry cost for Hezbollah is lower because they are not required to enter the political arena and disarm like all other militias in Lebanon. They are allowed to enter the political arena while remaining an armed group. So there is basically an opening in the political system that allows them to participate, and at the same time, there is also a series of organizational factors that pushes them towards participation. One of them is that at the same time, late 1980s, early 1990s, they face a drain, a decline in their financial resources. There's been a change of foreign policy in Iran, and they get for at least 5 years one third less of their of their financial support, and they also get a more lukewarm political support from Iran. So they are basically, that also pushes them to diversify their funding pool and diversify their portfolio, so to speak, and to invest in institutional politics. There are other factors, but I'm summarizing some of the most important changes that occur in the late 1980s for Hezbollah.
One of the things you just noted earlier was this tendency to treat these organizations as quite similar, as having similar institutional organizations and be organized in the same way. And then for that reason, from a distance, one would say that, assume that Hezbollah and Hamas were similar and their paths forward from formation are similar. Is that the case in the research you do, is Hamas closer to Hezbollah, or is, as you write about the Irish Republican Army, are the similarities such that the IRA is closer to Hezbollah, or is Hamas closer to Hezbollah in its history and its transition from military functions to political functions?
Right. I think a lot of the problems that I found in the literature on these groups is that it tends to, in my opinion, of course, it tends to overplay the importance of ideology, meaning that part of the work I do is to kind of put that in perspective. So yes, these groups are highly ideological. They have very strong belief systems that guide their actions, but at the same time, they're also fairly rational, fairly strategic thinkers, and their political and military development is not just guided by this blind irrationality or ideology, but it's actually guided by cost-benefit analysis, and they are heavily influenced by their political constituency, by level of popular support for the group, and by their external environment. So I think if you take it into this into consideration, then the political development of Hamas and Hezbollah appear to be quite different. Because they're really in different social political situation, and they also are exposed to different kind of pressures internally and regionally. More importantly, or just as importantly, if I look at their organizational structure, and I give a lot of importance to their organizational structure and internal dynamics, then I can see that there is a big difference. On the one hand, you have Hezbollah being heavily institutionalized, strong command and control, one leadership, holding very strong control of the organization. And on the other hand, I have an organization like Hamas that on paper is organized like Hezbollah, but in practice has developed over the years geographically dispersed and at times overlapping leadership. And these at times overlapping leaderships are often in internal conflict within the group over politics versus military activities, for example. And they seem to respond to shifts in public opinion as well. One of the examples I make in the book is that if we look at Hamas level of military activities, armed activities, declines in the years immediately after the Oslo Agreement, which are the years where the level of Palestinian public support class struggle is at the lowest ever. And at the end of the 90s, when a perception that the people is going nowhere and that the promise of the Oslo Accord has not been delivered, then support for violence goes up, and together with it also Hamas is active. They're at least somewhat conscious of the shift in public opinion, which also backs my main point that they're not just ideological, they're very much looking at their political environment to make a decision. I don't know if Hamas is exactly like the IRA. I actually would say the case of the relation between IRA and Sinn Féin, there was more of a it was easier to separate the two wings because that was a conscious strategic decision of the organization to portray themselves as two separate parts. Whereas for Hamas, it is more complicated. But what I think is interesting is when I look at the political development of Hamas, I see recurrent periods when there is internal conflict over the role of armed struggle versus political activism, and when there are internal parts of the leadership that are actually want to push the organization towards political activism and downplaying the armed struggle, and vice versa. So it's a very much, So I would say that for Hamas, it's very much a work in progress. They're very much still deciding which way to go. And for the time being, they're happy to do both, but they have internal conflicts about it, which Hezbollah does.
Yeah. Right. There's just so much good stuff in this book. Before we finish up, I wonder if you can put some of these, some of what you found in the book in the context of the Arab Spring or the Arab Awakening.
Yeah.
What can we use from the book to make better sense of, for instance, what's going on in Syria and Egypt right now? What can we learn from and better understand about these two situations that without your book we might not understand fully?
Okay, so I would start by saying that one of the contributions that I try to make here is to depict and to analyze armed organizations that are normally treated in a very, I would say, simplistic, one-dimensional way to show the real complexity, which I think is something that we could use very well when we look about the evolving situation in the Arab world right now, because I do see that a lot of the analysis is still done through a very binary terms, modernity versus pre-existing sectarianism, political Islam versus liberal. I mean, reality is more complex than that. So I think that could be one insight. Another insight is that often when reading the sparse literature on political participation of armed groups or in general in the context of integrating armed or extremist factions into a political system, there is sort of an assumption that political integration will per se lead to moderation, meaning to relinquish the armed struggle and to accept the rules of the political game. One of the things that I noticed through this study is that doesn't necessarily happen unless there is a purpose strategy to have a dialogue, an integration, and a constant attention on looking at how these groups operate and to tailor the strategies that strategy directly to the group. What I mean is that a piecemeal policy, a one-size-fits-all policy in dealing with a rising political parties, being then Islamist or not, in the Middle East may backfire because it's oversimplistic, which is another insight from the book. The book is not necessarily relating to the political and social transformation of the Arab Awakening, because that is more a bottom-up civil society, social movement kind of mobilization. But some of the insights that I get, that I hope to get by looking at how to have a dialogue and integrate armed groups, can very much applicable to societies that are today more polarized than ever and more than ever in need to find a strategy to patch up their differences and pursue reconciliation. That part could be applicable.
No, as I mentioned, I really enjoyed what you've written, learning the history of these organizations, and how you put this together is just very interesting. What's next for you? Do you have another book project that you're in the midst of that we can look forward to?
Well, yes. slowly, but it's happening, mm-hmm. because this is a subject that I'm extremely interested in. So even after I completed this first manuscript, I felt that there was something still to be said about how to integrate armed groups into the political system. I'm now going even more in depth into the Northern Ireland peace process, and I'm actually looking at that as a possible template for the conflict that I work most closely with, which is the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I'm doing that through a particular lens, which is I'm looking at how the sequencing of the demand makes a difference in terms of leading to a successful or unsuccessful agreement. So it's not just what you ask, but when you ask it. And that's really what I'm doing at the moment.
Yeah, well, I look forward to this, and I'm sure it will turn out as well as your current book, which is Armed Political Organizations, published by Johns Hopkins Press and available widely. I hope that everyone has the chance to read this, both those that study comparative politics, study the Middle East, but I think those that are interested in social movements more generally could learn a lot about the nature of institutionalization of organizations from this. Benedetta, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation.